This is a podcast from the AHRC ICT Methods Network at www.methodsnetwork.ac.uk.
I should start by explaining where this is coming from. I'm not a computer scientist, I'm not a librarian, I'm not an archivist, I'm not an information scientist, I'm not a technical photographer. I'm a scholar who uses computers in her research and whose research has been radically changed by computers. So this paper is not an overview, but one researcher's view of one of the things that digital imaging has done for her. As a researcher, I guess I'm somewhere on the border between Harold stage one, where it merges into stage two. I'm not a lone scholar, I'm part of a team, which is known as the York Doomsday Project, but the only connection with York is its subject matter. But though we meet regularly to discuss what each of us is doing, and we collaborate more closely where collaboration is needed, we each have our own area of expertise and our own projects, and this is my current one. But I couldn't do it without intermittently drawing on the expertise and hiring the equipment and personnel of an established and heavily funded project. So computer-assisted humanities research is a broader church than the currently fashionable funding patterns suggest. And I mean any currently funding fashionless, whenever, not just at this precise moment. Often one can carry on quite happily by oneself, but needs intermittent expert help, besides the regular shots of constructive criticism, which are provided by your co-workers in the project. It totally depends on the type of inquiry. And I'm not even thinking at the moment as to how I should present the final results, because I don't know yet what they're going to be. Funding applications do channel you into promising all too often too precise deliverables. But this is a process. I don't know. I may find nothing. Archaeologists at least must sometimes find that there's nothing there. So, come on, move. Thank you. Are you able to see that clearly? Because it looks absolute crap on this screen, I have to say. That is one of my objections to working on TFT screens. They are useless for doing delicate stuff on manuscripts. I don't know why, but it seems to project all right. The colours are more or less, I mean, it looks total rubbish on this. Anyway, that is actually a technical beef which I continually have. So, as a historian of medieval theatre, my raw material is largely manuscripts. And thanks to digital imaging, I can now take them home with me to work on. And it seems generally agreed that digitisation is a good thing. But in practice, that the quality of the goods provided will vary with the perception of what the user will want to do with it. And we've had this discussion all yesterday, and well, that was had again. If I just want to read a manuscript or look at an image for its iconographical content, I can be happy with a reasonably low resolution that most projects offer to you on the web, even as sometimes as JPEGs and GIFs. But if I were, for example, working on gesture in 12th century English Terence manuscripts, I'd be perfectly happy with that. But if I were an art historian, I think I might want to see the detail of the size that they offer it really on the early manuscripts at Oxford University website, but probably I would want a copy of the original, uncompressed. And the colour should be properly balanced, or it should give me an industry standard grey and colour scale which I can calibrate it against. For example, the CVMA corpus is a splendid resource, but some of it has been digitised from extremely iffy 35mm slides from the National Monuments Record, I guess. So the quality of what you get is very much a gamble. And of course, you don't know what your readers will want to use it for. The ideal would be to go for the highest possible achievable resolution, at least for your masters. And of course, that would cost. Come on, nicest shift. Thank you. There has been a certain alarm, however, that one can get perfectly adequate scans of manuscript pages for €1 a shot. To which the question is, adequate for what? It's difficult enough already trying to explain to archivists that their nice new digital camera is unfortunately not quite suitable for what you want. Though if you do mention 144 megapixels, their jaws do tend to drop slightly. But it's not unreasonable in them to suppose that once the manuscript has been photographed once, that ought to be it. So I do hope we are not looking at a future which is blanketed with €1 images. tender beef number two. You also need an expert photographer. Photography is a highly professional craft skill, and a good craftsman or woman can make all the difference between a usable and an unusable image, though they would both look identical at this size. The point of high-resolution imaging of manuscripts is the on-screen effect of enlargement. The document that I'm working on at present is about 225 millimetres wide at the top and 290 to 93 millimetres deep. That's it in actual size, if you can imagine. It's slightly narrower than a page of A4. And the writing, which I can indeed pass round, is correspondingly small. That's its real, actual size. And in one case, it is minuscule. It's absolutely written with, apparently written with a late medieval mapping pen. But with an 850 dpi scan, the letters are large enough for you to see the flow of the ink, which you may well want to do. And even the mapping pen, I am delighted to say, there is the mapping pen in toto, and there's its close-up down below, comes out large enough for you to see a minute addition between words, which was totally missed out by the latest editors of the manuscript. But they could have seen it if they'd known it was there. But, right? So I'll come back to other uses of this later. And you're not, of course, tied to a particular size of view. You can zoom in and out on it. Some things actually are more readable when enlarged, and some things are more readable when shrunk, especially in ultraviolet. It very much depends on how your particular eye focus is actually when you're trying to read. So, what does working with digital imagery do for you? Well, it may seem obvious, but it does make you aware of detail. You see things you can see in real life but don't actually notice, like this minute go. It may be something to do with having the light source behind the screen, but it particularly draws your attention to changes in ink and erasures. Now, this is accepted as the earliest recorded reference to Pageants at York. It's in a list dated 1376. But you can see with half an eye that the ink is a completely different colour and that it's been done, at the beginning at least, over the top of an erasure. And indeed, that the hand is different if you stop and look at it. I haven't yet positively identified where else this hand appears, which could give us a date, but my preliminary research suggests that we may have to post-date this by at least 20 years. When you go back to the manuscript, of course, the fact of the alteration is perfectly clear because your attention has been drawn to it on screen. But again, nobody seems to have noticed it before now, and so the whole theory of the prehistory of the plays will have to be reconsidered. So, an enhanced awareness of detail. But this may have an effect on the kind of work that I'm currently doing. At least, I seem now naturally drawn to altered and damaged manuscripts. This is partly because they provide a challenge. And there's a real kick in the problem solving, in being able to read something that nobody's seen for 500 years. And of course, all the projects which have caught the public's attention seem to involve detective work, but especially with forensic aids. And some of the more entertaining and interesting websites are, many of which you will know, and I pass around URLs, the Vindolanda tablets, which have actually melted away, leaving only the scratches on the back, and that uses overlapping images of the same object, photographed with light sources from different angles. I believe it's a technique developed for satellite spy imaging, but it's a beautifully simple concept, and you can do it with perfectly ordinary lights. Though the website, I have to say, is a devil to find your way around. The Oxyrhynchus papyri, which are in little bits, and spend a lot of time using multispectral images, including the UV and IR ends of the spectrum, which is described inevitably as NASA imaging technology. The Herculaneum papyri, which are burnt. Documents are particularly enticing, it seems, if incinerated, especially in dramatic circumstances. The Archimedes palimpsest, which presumably was just insufficiently up to date and they thought they could recycle it. Fine. This is a good website for explaining the procedures, even though it is a bit self-indulgent. And it does also tell you when things didn't work, which I find very encouraging. Now, all these are large projects which use a wide range of techniques, mostly spectrometry. I can't say it. I don't know why they invented this bloody word. Spectrometry. Yeah, spectrometry. One which was much simpler in its time, but as effective for what it needed to do, was the electronic Beowulf. And now we have Boethius, son of Beowulf. Less newsworthy, probably because it involves medieval polyphony, which is not so sexy in the papers, but which has by far the best explanation of how their imaging is done and what the rationale behind it is, and gives you some hope that you might be able to do it yourself, is the Digital Image Archive of Medieval Music, DIAM. And I owe them a particular debt of gratitude, as their project manager, Julia Craig McFeely, gave me a rapid masterclass in her techniques. And they are the group whose camera and photographer I bought in for at least two projects in which I'm involved. The manuscript on which I'm working at present is an ideal case study. First of all, it's a palimpsest in patches. Now, this is intriguing from the problem-solving point of view, but more important than the challenge of reading an underlying text is the fact that the alterations and the emendations show a historical process. Now, that was what Andrew was talking about some time back. This is an official document which more than most reflects the process of change in the events that it was created to prescribe. To be precise, it's the York City Council list, first assembled in 1415, of the pageants of what are now commonly called the York Mystery Plays. It was entitled, the Ordo Paginarum, and you can see that even the word paginarum has been altered, which makes me very interested. I want to get properly underneath that. The Order of the Pageants, as in the Order of Service. It only covers six sides of the city's official memorandum book, folios 252V to 255R, but it was used every year as a copy text for the billets, which were sent out to the craft and trade guilds, which summoned them officially to bring forth their individual pageants on the morning of Corpus Christi. But the list of the pageants and the guilds which were responsible for them didn't remain static. For financial and artistic reasons, guilds combined and recombined responsibilities for a pageant, and they updated the scripts when they felt necessary. And this went on for at least 150 years, and each change is reflected in this document. David Luscombe informed me that this is called a mobile document, which I like very much. Most of the work, in fact, has been done on changes to guild attributions. The guild attributions are on the left-hand side, and the descriptions of the pageants are on the right-hand side. Many of these changes can be dated from external evidence, but there are equally drastic changes in the descriptions of the pageants themselves. But again, fewer people have noticed them, partly because the manuscript is so messy. I've given you a range here of various forms of alteration. A guild which took over, for example. In fact, this was a double pageant. It was the only double pageant with two wagons, three kings coming from the east, and Mary with the baby and the star above, and the three kings offering gifts. So they were two separate pageants. And then the goldsmiths were rich, ran them both. Then the goldsmiths decided they had become poor, and the masons were free-floating at the time, and they said, can we do one of them? And so they did. So the masons are there, and the masons take over this one, and the goldsmiths keep that one. And then there are additional characters, which have got the green lines around them, which have been added later on. And the names were all in Old French, but later on again, the scribe has changed it to the English version. So that's just a small bouquet of the kind of alterations. Here we've got an erasure of a complete pageant, and indeed the amalgamation of two pageants in one. You can see the, maybe, you can see the join down there, and you can see the erasure. Again, I need to get under there to see what the two separate ones said to begin with. You may or may not have noticed that it is also in two hands. Did you notice that? Well, right, okay. Here I've got the different hands marked up in different colours in the transcription. Seems to be a good way of doing it. take a moment to spot. This is where the second guy starts. Right? And you can see that he's done it over a scraping out. Now the question is this the same person as wrote the short list, which was written slightly later, but still shows these as two separate pageants, and it shows the one that's, there's the one that's been scraped out, there's the first one there, and there's the second one there, and they are down as three separate pageants. So we want to know, in whose hand is this alteration, and is it the same as wrote this list? And the answer is probably yes. It was probably Roger Burton, the common clerk, from 1415 to 1435-36. There's no room here to show the comparisons of all the hands from all the various parts of the manuscript which I've picked up. But yes, he does seem to have written both the alterations and the second list, and the signed history of the archbishops, which almost immediately precedes the Ordo Paginarum in the book. And one of the clinchers was the word quinque. Here we've got it from the short list of pageants, there we've got it from the history of the archbishops, and there is the history of the archbishops overlaid on the short list of pageants. And I think the important thing about this is that the ductus seems to be the same. Not that the letter forms are the same, because you can just end up, if you're doing automatic comparison, say, yes, this guy writes the same script. I, however, continue to obsess about the top of the first Q in quinque. And these are, I'm delighted to find out, methods that forensic document examiners also use for comparing all sorts of things that I worked out, actually, for teaching kids paleography and comparing hands with closeness of homonyms and length, angle to the baseline and so forth, are also used by forgery experts. So that's nice. And he's not the only person. He's the person that did the alterations. He's not the same as the person that wrote the original document, because not only do they write in a different script, their ductus is quite different. There's the first guy, there's the second guy. The first guy does bookhand A's and G's. The second guy does secretary A's and G's. And this is quite important, as we'll find in a little while. So, what we seem to have here is the chief executive, who was the second guy, making executive decisions about alterations to a document which he had ordered somebody else to copy out in the first place, but over a subsequent period of about 20 years. So we get, as I said at the beginning, an image of a historical and to a certain extent a cultural process. The fact that it happens to reflect the history of mystery plays is incidental. The important thing is that a manuscript can show historical process. In another project in which I'm involved, it shows literary process. This is the Journal of George Fox, which was dictated to his stepson-in-law, Thomas Lower, between possibly 1675 to 8. And you can see on it two layers of correction, there and there. One, apparently, as he was dictating, no, scrub that, write this. And the other, sometime after, but how much time, sometime after, we don't know. But Lower's handwriting is much more formal the second time round. The way he scrubbed things out round the second time round is different. So again, we've got a whole history here of oral composition of the founding document of the Quaker sect. But this manuscript is also an epitome of absolutely everything that can happen to a manuscript, except fortunately cremation, though it did have a pretty narrow escape from that. It was kept in the Guildhall. 1942, that happened to the Guildhall. But fortunately, in the angle between the Common Hall and the Old Council Chamber, it was just round the corner in a presumably metal filing cabinet, so it was not damaged in the slightest degree. Students of history everywhere will feel grateful to the corporation for the precautions they adopted to save their historical treasures. Well, maybe. In the 19th century, as you can see, something rather nasty and damp happened to it. They kept it in the basement of the Common Hall. This is a pretty picture of the ooze, and it's only when you see where the waterline is meant to be that you realise what happened to that unfortunate manuscript in 1892. Also, sometime before 1892, some anti-Catholic zealot a tactic with a paper knife, or maybe he was just a DIY fanatic and using it as a cutting board, who can tell. And then the damage was mended by well-meaning archivists with paper patches, which were attached with various kinds of glue, apparently. And underlying ink has started to seep through, but originally it just did remove all the underneath writing. The City Archives houses another example of archivist vandalism. Do you remember Oak Galls? They brought up faded writing so nicely. This is the Scrivener's Pageant of Doubting Thomas. And until 1844, when Madden identified a mysterious manuscript bought by the Reverend Thomas Russell as the full script of the surviving plays, this was the only text of a York mystery play known to exist. I couldn't resist tinkering with it, which is a good demonstration both of the sort of thing you can do and how unsatisfactory it is to do it on a JPEG. And then I messed about with Kevin Kiernan's piece of Boethius, which I stole offline as a very small GIF, and also shows what you can do and how unsatisfactory it is to do with a GIF. And it has been suggested to me, looking at that, that these techniques will be extremely useful for the decipherment of Icelandic sagas, which used to be kept in the rafters of Icelandic farmhouses and then got kippered and are unreadable. So I'm waiting for my saga colleagues to come up with smoky photos. So manuscripts are physical objects to which untoward things happen. So what do we do with them? Why do we want to do it? The main concern of the projects I've cited is to read the text, words or music, it doesn't matter. And if this were all I wanted to do, you could ask why I needed to. Because in the 1880s, Lucy Toulmin Smith, one of the heroic female figures of the York Records, she transcribed it for the introduction to her 1885 OUP edition of the York Mystery Play. So she saw it before the flood of 1892. She didn't transcribe all of it. She's mostly extremely accurate, though there are one or two bits where she isn't. But she wasn't interested in the different hands, although she noted some of the main alterations. She thought they were by the same person. And her major interest, as you might expect at the time, was in the content. So my interests are at a tangent to hers. I want to read the original text. I hope you noted the text that she was showing, because this is it. But I also want more urgently to determine where there were alterations, and if possible, in whose hands they are. And this is a painstaking and fiddly business. And this is part of my notes. Come back again, thank you very much. This is part of my notes to myself on the subject. So lots and lots and lots of variations. Come on. And here we have a little problem down the bottom. And you can see that I'm worrying about something you could hardly see, and whether or not it was written by hand A or written by hand B. And it says at the bottom very firmly, this is not finished. That is a note to myself. Go on. It doesn't really matter what kind of disaster, intentional or otherwise, has rendered the text illegible or downright invisible. The methods of recovering it are very similar. And they depend upon having Adobe Photoshop, which is a proprietary tool which has become almost universal, and also having the best digital scans you can get. Aha, yes, and those are the specs for the photography, which was done for me by the Diam photographer. And that incidentally ensured that they have all the necessary metadata and are also deposited for storage with the AHDS and the OTA, and I didn't have to do a thing about that. I won't read through it, but you can see. The copyright is an interesting thing. The original scans, according to the Diam's very careful copyright license, belong to the owner of the manuscript. The archive copies are licensed to Diam for deposit and preservation. But when I have manipulated the images, it is written that the copyright in those manipulated images belongs to me. So there's quite a tangled web there which needs to be regarded. Who paid for it? I did. This solves a lot of problems. The Adobe tools that are most useful are Level Adjust, which you can do on individual RGB channels. Curves is also useful. Replace Color, which is brilliant. And both this and Color Select, you do with, you pick a pixel and you use the color slider. If I had had time, I would show you, but I don't think I will show you because there isn't time. But you use that color slider to pick up anything from one pixel, which is zero, to pixels in the colour range all the way along there. You could take it right the way up to 150, but you really don't want to go much above 25 if you're playing about with this. And then colour select, which you can use once you've clicked up certain ranges to copy them to a new blank screen so you don't get interference from all the messy background. And then it has, which is really useful, the layers facility, which means that you can make all sorts of different adjustments and slide them up and down and pick certain ones and see which ones if they're overlaid. Somebody said they may be able to work out a way of putting up infrared over the top of ordinary ones. Well, you can. You just whack your picture in an Adobe and make sure it's the same size. Bob's your uncle. You can do that. You can do it with... I've done things with ultraviolet. So, I've got my links and my pictures, I have to remember. Here's an example of a damaged page. I'm just going to show you something that I've done at the top by using other methods. You see the bit at the top? It has been scraped out, it has been overwritten. You can't see the scraping out. I won't do this bit because... But, yes, wouldn't it be easier to use ultraviolet? Yes, but it's quite a blunt image. And that's, you have to go through a whole range of procedures in order to get it usable, and then some. And if you blow up your ultraviolet, that's what you get of one thing. If you do colour select after various other manipulations, that's what you get. You see, you've got two separate images, and they're both useful for different things. Okay, here we are. There's the picture at the top. This is written by Mr. Mapping Pen. There's the UV underneath. You can see that there is something under there now. In fact, now I know what's there, I can see it, which is really annoying. But can you see what's underneath? You can see bits, I think. But play about with it, play about with the UV quite a lot. Then, if you copy the original over the top, now, Julia likes making the parchment colour, but I prefer having it white because then it's like looking, I find it's like looking through a painted fence at the garden behind. Your eye disregards the painted fence and looks at what's behind. And eventually, when you've tweaked and fiddled about a bit more, then that's a colour select, and there you have what it says. Now, I can see what it says. Can you see what it says? Some of them you have to get in really close, some of them you have to... okay, so the original guy wrote, and this is all the original guy's writing, it's very convenient, this is a different size, and he said much less, so that you can actually get between the things. But he said, Frenchies and their bodies to prison, and that Ilka player, that something, which is probably Charles, I don't know, play, that he, beautiful he, you can see that, be ready in his pageant at possibly convenable, I still don't know yet, I want a better shot of that one, time of pain of imprisonment and that forfeiture to be raised that is ordained therefore. There. Now, I worked that out partly by comparing different words with other words in the same hand, which were actually also out of ultraviolet, so they were all a bit iffy, but you can if you work very hard at it. That's a slightly different version of it, with the colours changed. And don't forget the show through. This is just that don't forget the show through. You can see their form beautifully there in the show through, and I didn't actually realise I had it until I started playing back with a very, very pale greeny blue pixel. Woo-hoo! And again, you have to overlay what was actually on it and reverse it. But you can do it. It's brilliant. So, recently I've enlisted the help of Trevor Emmett from Anglia Ruskin University's Department of Forensic Science, who's brought on along his special scene of the crime lab and taken a picture of the same thing. The only trouble is you can see it much better in real life. It's murder to photograph. And the granularity is not good. Again, if I look, I can see the movable word there, and it seems to be con the bit that I couldn't read. But because you have to hold the light really close up to it, you can't take a distant photograph of it. And he did it on black and white emulsion. I want him to come along again and do this, and also bring in the Diane photographer and see if we can work out a comparison between the two so that it comes out properly. My experience is very much, this is horses for courses, you need to try everything and see what happens. I haven't yet subjected the manuscript to the VSC. Are you familiar with the VSC? If not, the best description about it is on the FBI website, which I've given you on the URLs. It's lovely, brilliant. And those are the people that make it, and they tell you all sorts of exciting things. It is basically a machine customised for the forensic document examiner, and it includes a lot of features you could find in Photoshop. And I can't work out from the spec what kind of digital output it actually has. The earliest one I just showed you on a black and white monitor. If you wanted to take it away for use of some evidence, you just took a photograph of the black and white monitor. There was no video capture, and it seems to store images as bitmaps, which makes me a bit ugh. But it has various filters which remove areas of the spectrum, and it also has devices for visualising indented writing and embossing and so on and so forth. And I had hoped that I would be able to come along and show you work from that, but you have to go over other people's timetables, so I haven't got hold of him yet. This is what they particularly say it's good for, and indeed, this is one of my major preoccupations. Will I be able to do that with shoving the thing under the VSC? But I did actually, as a light final touch, I did actually manage to find, uncover a partly concealed dead body in my manuscript. Can you see it? Just by using Photoshop. It says mortal and corpse. It was the dead body of Christ. Over the last couple of years, I've personally been fed through a variety of very interesting scanners, MRI scanners, CAT scanners, you name it, I've been fed through it. Wonderful. And each time I've wondered whether there was a version of this which would actually help me with my erasures. And the ultrasound got me, but presumably also it got my molecules particularly excited. And apparently they do use a shallow ultrasound scanner for dermatology research. But then again, I don't know about potential damage to the subject. Right, stop. So, go on, go on, go on. Yeah. So,